Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 24th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Time or Money, The Crucial Choice, presented by John DeGraff. Let's listen in.
It's great to be here at Holden. This is my sixth year of teaching at Holden, six of the past seven, actually, and it's always been a delightful experience and terrific interactions, and I've met some of you in past years and made some friends, and so it's been great to see people again after many, many years. I'm going to be doing in the 5 days that I'm here is a little bit of a potpourri. Some of it will follow, and a lot of it is based on the work that I do as a filmmaker. I'm a documentary film producer. I work at the PBS affiliate in Seattle, KCTS-TV, and I have been making documentary films for nearly 30 years, actually started in Minneapolis, Channel 2. Some of you Minnesotans are probably familiar with that. But there's always been a kind of a connection for me between the documentary work that I do and my own beliefs and sort of activism in trying to make the world a better place, and I make no apologies for that. That's really what I see my work fundamentally as being, not just making TV, but trying to make media that can make a difference in the world and make our world a better place. During the week, today we're going to be talking a little bit about some choices, and I was very interested in John's discussion of economics as choices, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about what I see as some major choices that were made in one of those two groups. And how many of you were here for John Wallace's wonderful lecture just before? And he talked about the two groups, the sort of rich countries and the poor countries. And I'm going to not talk in this particular talk about the poor countries. I'm going to talk about choices made in the rich countries of the world, and primarily compare choices made in an economic sense in the countries that comprise the original European Union, 15 countries, and you can add to that countries like Norway and Switzerland, which are not in the European Union but are quite similar, and compare them to the United States and look at some 30-year period and then ask some questions about, you know, why these different choices were made and what you think about the outcomes which I'll present. And I guess the basic question that I always think needs to start any conversation about economics, and I am not an economist, I only play one on TV, but no, I don't do that either, but I work a lot with economists, and I guess the first question always in my mind, and maybe in the mind of many non-economists, is we're constantly hearing, what will that do to or for the economy? This is a continual question whenever you come up with any kind of policy ideas. What will that do to or for the economy? And my response, and I think more economists now, is that we need to start with an earlier question, which is, what is the economy for? What do we see the economy being about? Is the economy about having the grossest domestic product, or the highest Dow Jones average, or these kind of things? Or does the economy have some other purpose? Namely, I would sort of say, use the phrase that Gifford Pinchot — how many of you have heard of Gifford Pinchot? He was the first director of the United States Forest Service, first chief of the Forest Service, and he spoke of the goal as being the greatest good for the greatest number over the long run. And I think all three of those are important, and they speak to what we're thinking about here when we ask this question, what is the economy for, and how can we discover whether the decisions we're making are getting us toward the greatest good for the greatest number over the long run. So I'm going to start with a series of little graphs. And people say I should put these on PowerPoint when I give these talks, but I've been told that power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So this is my excuse for not putting all of these on PowerPoint. But this first graph stands for productivity per hour. This is how much do people — economists know a lot about this — how much do people actually produce over the course of an hour? And I want to compare two places, this original EU 15 and the United States, and I want to look at the years 1970 to 2000. The reason I want to use those years is because I fundamentally believe that after a period of time in which the United States was doing things, as John pointed out, which we had a first a period of growing inequality, and then a period of definitely growing equality following World War II, and on up, I would say, until the early 1970s. And then we reversed that. We went from a policy that was more and more about, I think, the things Dan was talking about sharing, about we're all in this together, about what we do to the least of those among us, to a policy that said, and I would call it the you're on your ownership society. It would say, you know, it's a kind of dog, everybody for themselves, and let that will give us the highest growth, and that growth will then trickle down or on the folks at the bottom. In that same period, the Europeans did not make, for the most part, such a decision. They continued on what they consider or call their social contract. And while there were some differences and ups and downs here and there in terms of what those policies were in Europe, the general policy was to continue the kinds of things that Europe and the US had been doing following World War II. So when I look at productivity per hour in 1970, and we'll make the blue be the US and the red be Europe here, we'll put the US right here. And where do you think, how do you think Europe compared to us in 1970? What do you think their productivity rate was on average? In
less.
How much less?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Not much.
About a third less. About 65%, roughly. So here's the EU at that time. Now, what happened over this period? The United States increased productivity by some 80%, goes up like this over the period. And the EU countries, what did they do?
Flat?
No.
They almost caught up.
As John says, that's exactly right. They go up to approximately 95% in the year 2000, and in some cases of some countries, namely Norway, France, Belgium, they're actually a little bit higher in productivity per hour compared to the United States. So they nearly catch up when we have this measurement of productivity. Now let's look at another statistic, and this is all about how much we consume, how many goods and services we actually consume, what our essentially material standard of living is as measured by this gross domestic product per capita. So we see the United States here, and we see its consumption increasing overall roughly the same as production, a little bit less, but consuming almost 80% more. Now that was much more divided by 2000 than it was in 1970. We'll talk a bit more about that. But then Europe, in 1970, we see Europe, and actually the rate in Europe was slightly higher than the 65, close to 70%. And today, where do you think it stands?
Half as much as us.
Half as much as us.
Depends on which.
Really, we're talking about 2000, right?
Yeah, about
2000.
Actually, about the same, about two-thirds, about 65. Or 70, roughly no change in a percentage basis.
Yeah.
Pardon?
They caught up, they were accelerating up until the 90s. The 90s were as good for Europe as they were.
Okay, we could do
you could do
the line more like that.
Yeah, okay. A little bit there.
Okay, that's true. But
there's a big current debate about whether the catching up was transitory or not.
Okay, well, in a certain sense, in this sense, it is not, because their consumption is roughly two thirds of what ours is today. Now, what you folks guess, what accounts in some ways for that strange anomaly that the Europeans catch up with us in productivity per hour, but they don't catch up with us at all in gross domestic product? In fact, the gap remains as big, and in absolute terms, a little larger. What accounts for it? And it's this, in some parts, it's this figure. Not only that figure, but this is the primary difference.
Working hours.
So in 1970, Europeans and Americans worked roughly the same number of hours. The Europeans worked actually just a tiny bit more. You figured about 105, and compared to the United States. Where do those figures stand today? What's happened to U.S. working hours? It's debatable. Some people say they've gone up. Some people say they've stabilized or gone down slightly. Certainly, they've gone up when you consider families, where both people are working. But it's sort of a flat line if you take the United States. That's Europe. Okay? Got to get these lines right. Doing my best imitation of John Madden here. And where do the European hours go?
Down.
At the same time.
Down.
They go down. They go down to about 80%. So a rather major drop. So that today, on average, the average Western European is working somewhere between 300 and 350 hours less per year in paid employment than the average American. Something close to 9 weeks difference. Much of that is accounted for by vacation time. You may know that you cannot join the European Union without guaranteeing every citizen in your society at least 4 weeks of paid vacation. 4 weeks, 20 days. And most countries are doing more than that. How many days of guaranteed paid vacation do Americans get? I'm not talking about here about holidays. I'm talking about paid vacations. How many days?
Guaranteed.
Zero. Zero. Guaranteed.
Mandated by law.
Mandated by law. Right. Mandated by law. So only industrial country in the world where that's the case, where vacation days are not mandated by law. Okay, so that goes down. And so what's happened here? We've made essentially these two different societies have made something of a choice, an economic choice. The Europeans have said, we value leisure to a greater degree than Americans have said that. Americans have said to a greater degree than Europeans, we value stuff. So this is a choice. Two societies, not necessarily consciously. A lot of what we do is not conscious, and we don't really sit down and say that. And in fact, often most of us in our working life don't have a whole lot of real choice about that. But in fact, that's what happened. So now the question.
What about labor force participation?
Labor force participation.
I mean, that plays into
employment. Yeah.
Yeah, because the average hours worked is average hours worked per employed person. And part of what happened in America is more people, the percentage of the population that's working rose as women entered the labor force. Part of that was offset by men retiring earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of this, a little bit of this picture, because I think America had a bigger shift than Europe did.
Yeah, but also per worker employed, the hours are lower.
I'm not disputing that per worker employed at all. But mm-hmm. in terms of the percentage of the population of working age that's actually working,
yes,
there's
is higher
in
the States.
In America. And that's, I mean, we would probably argue
it's gone up in a way in both places, but much more so in the United States. That's true. And that's a little more complicated than what.
Yeah, okay.
Hopefully, John. Anyway, now, and again, as John mentioned in his talk, he has to oversimplify, and I have to oversimplify. What I'm trying to do is give you some broad parameters, kind of a big picture, from which we can just think about what's going on and whether, in fact, we like what's going on, or we that's the way we want to go. I want to show you now a little bit of a film, kind of about the choice we did make and about some of the impacts of that. Stay. Okay. Let's hope this is going to work. We may need to, I don't know if you'll be able to see very well with the out the curtain coming down a little bit.
Somebody put the curtains down back there.
Great, thank you. Okay, we'll try it.
They buy a boombox and it makes it feel better, but I don't need to feel better.
It looks like it's going to play fine. He's playing. From a film of mine, some of you may have seen this, done in 1998, called Escape from Affluenza.
Funding for Escape from Affluenza was provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Summit Charitable Foundation, the Merck Family Fund, and the Peet Charitable Trust.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
This is Roberto Di Nero with a shocking development to report. Those are the Joneses, the American family we've all been trying to keep up with for years. As you can see by the white flag, they are surrendering.
We've had it. We're exhausted. We never see each other anymore. And we have so much debt, it's just not worth it. So please, stop trying to keep up with us.
So what's next?
We're just going to try living better on less.
And there you have it, the Joneses surrender.
I'm Wanda Urbanska. About 10 years ago, my husband, Frank Levering, and I decided to call a halt to keeping up with the Joneses. The cost was too high. The long hours we had to work to pay for it all meant we hardly ever saw each other. We were successful writers, but we weren't happy. At the suggestion of Frank's elderly parents, we moved here to the Blue Ridge Mountains to take over the orchard that had been in their family for generations. It was a big gamble because the orchard was deep in debt. Making it profitable again meant we had to learn frugality in a hurry. It wasn't always easy, but we found living simply to be full of rewards. Time was the biggest. Time for family, friends, community affairs, and good conversation. Farm work is hard, but seasonal. We still had time to write, and we wrote a book called Simple Living about our experiences. The response we got told us we weren't alone.
In the 10 years since Frank and I left the fast lane for a simpler life, we met many other people who are finding ways to live better on less. You'll meet some of them, too, a little later in this program. But first, some history.
Four out of five experts say millions of Americans have fallen victim to a debilitating disease called affluenza. Symptoms include swollen expectations, shopping fever, chronic stress, fractured families, festering social scars, and resource exhaustion. Affluenza is a painful addiction to the relentless pursuit of more, and if not treated, can lead to perpetual discontent. Experts believe affluenza will become a household word as the epidemic continues to spread.
It's
Surveys show that most Americans, regardless of income, think they'd find happiness if they only had twice as much money as they do now. But they also show we're no happier now than we were 40 years ago, when we only had half as much or less.
People feel sad, and what do? They go to the mall and they shop, and they buy a boombox, and it makes them feel better. But it only makes them feel better for about a week, and after that, they're still sad, and they have the boombox sitting on the shelf or something.
Stop. Hard Rock Cafe, Las Vegas. You were in Las Vegas?
Right. And I bought a t-shirt, and as you can see, I had to even take it out of the bag.
People usually lose their shirts in Las Vegas.
At a public forum in Chicago, 40 people have been brought together by an organization called the Center for a New American Dream to discuss their buying habits. They were randomly chosen by a polling firm to represent the region's diversity. All were asked to bring one item they purchased but didn't really need.
This is the incredible food dehydrator, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's quite a little item.
Well, tell us how you happened to acquire it.
It was on TV. Credit card 800 number and UPS, and I'm in business.
Well, no, they're in business.
Yes, they are. And that was it. And then the thing was, I think I spent more time cleaning it that I actually was using this.
You didn't get up at a given morning and say, you know, honey, we really need a dehydrator.
No. But I do this all the time. My wife and I do it. We have our whole kitchen's filled with things.
Sounds like we could have your whole kitchen on the table here.
In my garage, too. I've got everything. Everything, yeah. You know, we just buy everything we can.
Soon, most of these products are likely to end up in a landfill.
When I first started working here, I was really amazed at the amount of material that people threw away. A lot of things I thought could be salvaged and reused. You get carpeting, sofas, chairs, tables, and over here is a lawnmower, a computer monitor, kitchen sinks, and whatever.
This in a city, Seattle, with one of the highest rates of recycling in America. Even here, the piles of stuff simply thrown away keep growing.
Recycling has been a real successful product, but it's partial. We don't want to lean that far on it because really the big success story would be preventing the waste in the first place.
Just how much does a typical middle-class American consume? In 1990, Sid Corrier tried to figure that out by adding up everything his family had used in the previous 20 years.
M&M's almost every day. Did you figure that in?
3 bags of M&M's per week is 3,000 bags of M&M's. 2 pounds of beef a week, that's 4,000 pounds.
Corrier shared his calculations with Alan Williams, a colleague at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection.
6 radios, 1 VCR, 3 alarm clocks, 2 stereo systems, 700 batteries, 3.5 tons of newspaper, 10,000 gallons of heating oil, 3 televisions. It just goes on and on.
As they examined the resources required by Sid's middle-class lifestyle, he and Alan were astonished.
And what frightened me is that both Sid and I consider ourselves environmentalists, and that if we were using these resources, what about the rest of the world? What about the rest of America?
Some scientists up in Canada recently figured out that to support all the world's people at the North American level of consumption, we'd need 4 planets. In other words, we're 3 planets short.
In the name of convenience, we've gone from designing products so they could be repaired to a reliance on throwaways.
25 years ago, the large bulk of footwear was resolvable, repairable. Everybody had the footwear repaired. It was automatic. And now things just don't get repaired anymore. So a little corner shoe repair shop, the 1-2-man shop that everybody used to go to, they're virtually disappearing. People just have gotten used to throwing footwear away.
And a lot of other things. Despite recycling, the average American throws away a ton of solid waste each year. And for every ton that ends up in the landfill, another 20 tons were originally used up to produce it.
Everything that we buy or use in our daily life has an ecological wake that ripples out across the ecosystems of the planet. I start my day with a cup of coffee. That coffee started as 100 beans growing on a tree in Colombia, in an area that was once cloaked with cloud forests, a kind of tropical forest that's now among the most endangered types. of tropical ecosystems. The beans were picked by a worker who made about $1 a day. They were shipped on a freighter made of steel from Japan, out of iron from Australia, fueled with diesel from Venezuela. Then the beans were unloaded in New Orleans, where they were roasted over flames of natural gas piped in from Oklahoma. The beans were then loaded in a 4-ply bag of 3 types of plastic resin and aluminum foil from the Columbia River system in Washington State. They were shipped across the country on an 18-wheeler, brought home from a grocery store in a brown paper bag made of Douglas fir trees from Western Oregon. They were ground in my kitchen in a grinder made in Taiwan with parts from 6 other countries. Then they were brewed in a coffee maker that was made originally in Germany out of parts from a bunch of other countries. The water came from the slopes of the Cascade Mountains, and the electricity came from a dam on the Columbia River. Then I enjoyed my cup of coffee.
So specialization, as we see, as John mentioned, does do wonders, has done some wondrous things for us. It gives us an awful lot of choices, but it does come, or can come, at a certain kind of price, and that's something that we may talk about later. Also on Wednesday, I'm going to be talking about the fair trade movement, which relates to things connected with coffee. But I want to kind of go back to this question about this difference in the choice between time and money, and I believe it, though it may not have been fully conscious, is certainly a real choice that separates, in a large way, Western Europe and the United States today. And the question is, who gained what in the things that we probably might want in a good society from this difference in approach that has taken place? So I want to start first with health. If we look at health, one thing we find is that in absolute terms, we're all healthy. The Americans live longer today than they did in 1970. They're in general more physically fit, although obesity and other kinds of things are creeping in a big way, and there's some concern about whether the next generation will be as healthy as this one. Europeans also are more healthier. But the difference is not in absolute terms, in which the United States goes up, but in relative terms, in which the United States, from basically a World Health Organization ranking roughly in the middle among industrial countries in 1970, now ranks where when we look at health? At the bottom, among all industrial countries. Poorest health outcomes in longevity, in infant mortality, in the performance of kids on tests of fitness, in chronic illness. How many of you saw the study that just came out about 2 months ago from the National Institutes of Health and the British Health Service? They did a study comparing health outcomes for Brits basically over 55 and Americans over 55, the period in which we start getting chronic health problems. How many of you saw that? It was actually front page news in every newspaper that I saw, but it was sort of an interesting thing because not that much was made of it. What did that study find?
Poor Brits are healthier than the wealthy Americans.
Poor Brits are healthier than wealthy Americans. This is sort of unheard of, because one thing we know in a country is that richer people are healthier than poorer people. That's true in every society. And we know that poor people in the United States often don't have health care and things like that, so it could be easily seen that poor Americans would be maybe less healthy than poor Brits who have a national health care system or something. But to find that the health of poor Brits was at least as good, if not better, than wealthy in the top third of Americans was an absolute shock. It was a shock to the National Institutes of Health. It was a shock to the British. It was a very surprising finding. And the overall finding was that Americans were about twice as likely to have any chronic illness after age 55 as the Brits were. Now, the other interesting thing about this is that it's fairly common knowledge that the British have the poorest health in Europe. They eat foods like we do, a lot of heavy foods. They drink a lot. They drink more than we do. They smoke about as much or slightly more than we do. So this whole thing was very confusing. And when we look at the stats for other countries, we find that the gap is even greater. What accounts for this gap? Why is it, do you think, that the Europeans have gotten healthier by comparison with Americans? What are some of the things that might lead us to have a decline in health?
We're sedentary.
We're more sedentary. That's a big one. Less exercise is a big one that came out in that particular study. Yes?
We don't have a decline in health.
We have a relative decline in health.
Yes, right.
No, we don't have an absolute. I said that.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. But you said, what would cause us to have a decline in health?
No, I'm sorry. Okay, a relative decline in health.
Yeah.
Compared to.
What's made Europe so much healthier, so much faster than we are?
Yeah, right. Okay. That's the point. Why are they getting healthier faster than we are? That's an absolute, you're absolutely right. I did try to make that point. Okay. Yes, in the back.
We don't have or don't take the time to eat healthily.
Okay, that's one of the things. Poor nutrition with fast food and all those kinds of things. Yes?
Stress. Leisure time.
Stress is a big one. Time stress. The factors that were discovered in the English model, some of the factors were particularly exercise, a big one. Food, not so much in the case of the Brits because they eat a lot of the same junky stuff. And certainly not smoking and drinking. But stress in the workplace, less feeling of security, particularly in terms of jobs and other things in the United States. Not the same kind of safety net, the health care, all of those kinds of things. And all of this, of course, comes at the fact with the fact that who spends the most money on health care?
U.S.
It's not close. It's not close. We now are close to 15% of our gross domestic product is spent on health care. About 60-some percent of that is private, but we also spend a lot of public money in the United States on health care. We do have about 46 million uninsured, unlike other countries, but we spend way more. We spend twice as much as the Brits do on average. We spend about 40% more than the closest European country, which is Switzerland, which also spends quite a bit on healthcare, but only about 60% as much as we do. So this is a strange thing. Here we ought to be the healthiest country in some ways. We're spending the most money to take care of our health, and yet in all of these outcomes, we rank very close to the bottom in almost every one. But what's another? What do medical schools now and schools of public health now consider to be the most important factor in good health? Pardon?
Relationships.
Wow, we got a smart crowd here. First answer is correct. Relationships. Families, friendships, all of those kind of things. The social structure, the fact that we have these relationships and that we have support systems from others is more important to our health than anything else. In schools of public health, we call it the Rosetto factor. And that's because of a study that was done in a little town in Pennsylvania called Rosetto. When in the 1950s, the scientists were very curious about why this town had people who commonly lived into their 80s, and that's much more common in America as a whole now because our health has, in absolute terms, improved. But in those days, most of the people who lived all around Rosetto only lived into their 60s, late 60s. And these folks in Rosetto were very healthy into their 80s. And so they asked the question, why is this? And they did a long-term study that actually spanned a generation. New York University, trying to remember the fellow's, the doctor's name, his last name is Wolf, but I'm blanking on his first name, who conducted these studies. And the first question was, you know, what does this? Could it be their diet? Said, well, maybe they were immigrants, most of them from a poor part of southern Italy, who lived in this town. And they said, well, no, actually, these people are so poor, their diet is pretty crummy. In fact, They're so poor that they substitute lard for olive oil in making their Italian dishes. Not a really good thing for your cholesterol and other things. So then you say, well, what about their physical environment? Well, what do these folks do for a living? They were coal miners. Not, you know, of course, that's not the women, but nonetheless, that has an impact on the overall numbers. So again, what explains this? And what they finally concluded was that it was the culture, which was a culture of looking out for each other, of importance of family, of friendship, a culture that actually frowned on conspicuous consumption, what the folks referred to in that town as putting on the dog. That was the term that was used to describe it. And so people lived a lifestyle of relative sharing, and certainly a very, very big focus on community, much more so than in the highly individualized American communities around them. But one thing Dr. Wolfe noticed was that the kids in Rosetto were starting to take on all the patterns of the kids in the other high schools around the area. They get, they wanted the car, they wanted this, they wanted that. And he predicted that within a generation there would be no difference between the longevity and the health of people in Rosetto and of people in the surrounding communities. That study was done in the mid-50s. Scientists came back and did the same study in the mid-80s, found that exactly the case, that it had completely changed and Rosetto's health outcomes were no different than those of the communities around them. And that led people to a thinking that actually has been followed up on around the world about the importance of community, of relationships and those kinds of things to our health. Well, how many people saw the study that came out about a month ago about loneliness in America and about relationships? Another big one. Several universities got together, Robert Putnam, one of the main authors who wrote Bowling Alone, finding that Americans have fewer people that they feel they can count on as friends or close friends today, that there's been even an almost 30% decline since 1985 when the study was last done. And that affects a lot of things about our life. You know, we see fewer families having dinner together today, about a 30% drop since 1970 in the percentage of families that regularly eat together. These sorts of sharings and things have been affected, and one of the things that has affected them is the time pressure and this particular choice. So I want to go then on to interrupt at any time too with questions, but I'll go on to next. This is, the E stands for equality. And this is looking at the sort of relative gap between rich and poor in societies around the world. And interestingly enough, we found a fairly similar trend that takes place where the U.S., which in 1970 still is a little below, a little less equal than most other industrial countries, but actually ranks 13th out of 22, today ranks where? At the bottom. The biggest gap, the UN puts up, by the way, you can find these statistics. It's amazing how many statistics you can find. I have them all with me if you want to see them. They're just tons and tons of. The UN measures everything. For 200 countries, they measure all these kind of things. So you can actually compare these kinds of numbers. So the US has dropped. It now has the biggest gap between rich and poor. It now has the most poverty and the most child poverty as a percentage of the population.
So that's strictly an economic equality.
Economic equality is what we're talking about here. Yeah, I mean, it's a much more complicated issue when we get to other kinds of things. Although economic equality has had some impact on things like gender equality and other things, and political participation, and of course even on health, because these things are very interconnected. Now here's another big one that has to do with, I would say, this choice of stuff. And the equality shows that we didn't all get the stuff. We all may be working as much, or in many cases more, but we didn't all get the stuff. Although I don't agree with many of the people on the left who say that, you know, the top 10 or 20% of the population made all the gains. I don't think that's true at all. I think the gains were much, much wider than that, but the gap grew, and that's a somewhat complicated subject, which I'm happy to go into at some point. But this is personal savings. It's a big one. Death. In 1970, the average American was saving about 10% of their income.
Really?
And the average European was saving about 8% of theirs. Today, the last stats that came out from the government were a savings rate in the United States below zero, minus 1.6%, spending more than we're earning.
Now, was that in 2000 or was that the...
No, that's not right now.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
In 2000, actually, the figure went down to about zero, close to zero. And we looked at this in Affluenza, in the film, the original film Affluenza. We bemoaned the fact that the U.S. in 1996 had a savings rate of 4%, compared to, at that point, a relative 10% or so in Europe, and even higher in Japan and other places, and we were moaning and groaning about this. And we then had, after 1996, we had four of the most prosperous years in U.S. history, without question. I mean, we had those last years of the 20th century, GDP went way up, money, and in a sense, everybody did benefit, although the rich benefited more. It was one time in which real incomes even rose for many people at the bottom. So you might have expected that we would, what would you expect? Would we have more money? Would we save more or less?
More.
You'd expect we might save more, but we didn't. In fact, the savings rates dropped. Now, the EU, where people were saving at 8% in 1970, now the average savings rate in the EU, according to The Economist, is 12%. So people have, and what's the importance of this? Does this matter? For one thing, it matters for people's sense of security. And it matters to be able to tide yourself over if any kinds of things drastic happen. We've had an enormous increase in bankruptcies in the United States. 1996 was the first year in American history that more people declared personal bankruptcy than graduated from college. 1996. Roughly a million people. In every year since, that number has increased, and so that last year, almost twice as many people declared personal bankruptcy as graduated from college. It won't happen this coming year. Why not?
Because they changed
the bankruptcy laws, right. So it's going to be harder to declare personal bankruptcy. But nonetheless, the problem is still there, and it's also reflected in other kinds of things like terms of trade and things, and that gets more complicated. The other thing I want to look at here is the impact on the environment. So if we look back at 1970, we find that European impact is roughly two-thirds of ours, about what we would expect. And we measure that in a couple of ways. One is this concept called the ecological footprint. How many people are familiar with that concept or have heard of it? I've heard of the ecological footprint. That's what the fellow was referring to when he said scientists in Canada came up with a thing and showed that we need four planets. Mm-hmm. Actually, the figure is now five. But it's the number of acres that it takes to provide for an average lifestyle in any particular place. Anybody know what that figure, the commonly accepted figure for the United States is and how many acres it takes to create an average lifestyle? You can find it. You can go to myfootprint.org, and you can find it, and you can find out what yours is. And it doesn't take very long. It's not exact, of course. It's oversimplified by a lot. But it gives you an idea, and you may be surprised at what it takes to produce your lifestyle. I know I was. I consider myself a person who lives pretty simply and stuff like that. I was pretty surprised. But the average, anybody want to guess? Average number of acres for an American?
200 acres.
No, not that much.
25,
right. Okay, so that's the ecological footprint for the U.S. And So we go up here, 20, 25 acres, et cetera. Now, the Europeans consume two-thirds as much as we do. So what do you think their ecological footprint is?
17.
Somebody said 17? Somebody said?
17, 18.
Well, it's actually about 12. So it's still more. It still would take 2.5 planets to suddenly, you know, without changes in technology and everything, but to suddenly spread the European lifestyle to the rest of the world. So right now, and they're not sustainable either, although we know that the technological changes and other things can allow us to grow in some ways without necessarily destroying everything. But if you look at both the ecological footprint, 25 versus 12 acres, it's a little higher in the northern European countries where they have high energy costs in the cold winters and things. But if you also look at energy, you get about the same result, about half the consumption of energy, and people pay more attention to that. How many of you have traveled recently in Europe?
How recent is recent?
Well, in the last 5 years. So one of the things that you'll notice that there are all sorts of little things, like you go to the airport and you see the escalator, and when there's nobody on it, it's not running. Because there's a little light a little beam that tells you when somebody's getting on the escalator. If you go to your hotel room now in virtually any EU country, you put your key card in the light slot when you enter the door, and then when you leave, you take it out and the lights go out. So you can't leave your lights on unless you don't want to get back in your room. And then there'll be something to... In some places now, traffic lights change to green when it's the sensor sees that there's nobody coming the other way. So there, you don't have as much... There's all kinds of little things that are done that actually make it so that you can have two-thirds the material consumption and only half the energy cost. Mm-hmm.
How much of this is also the difference between the idea of having things versus consuming things over and over? The minute something is gone, or we need, one piece of a set is bad, then we need to buy the whole set. Because that seems to be a lot of the difference between what I've seen in Europe and the United States, is that it's not that they don't want to have some of those things, but once they get them, it's not a matter of needing a new one every year. It's not this high consumption pattern that we seem to have bought into in the United States that seems to even broaden that ecological footprint.
Well, I'm sure that what you're saying is true. I don't have data specifically to back that kind of thing, so I don't really know about the data on that. But I think that is part of it, and there's more attention being paid to the idea of the lifestyle is more than the GDP. So what happens today is that we have folks who are saying the Europeans are just doing horrible. They call it Eurosclerosis. European economies are flat lines. They're not going anywhere. We have a Nobel Prize-winning economist whose name is Edward Prescott. He's from the Arizona State University, won a Nobel Prize, who goes and speaks all over Europe. And what he tells the Europeans is, he says, you should cut all your taxes, all these things that pay for the social programs and things. Cut your taxes, because if you cut your taxes, then people will work more. So then Europeans will really work more, and your GDP will go up and all this sort of stuff, and people will work more. And the reason we want people to work more, he says, is this, because we have an advantage in doing what we are skilled to do. So that it's in a doctor's interest to work as many hours as he possibly can, or she, because that's where they can earn the highest rate of income per hour, and then to hire someone else who I would say has a comparative advantage at being a servant to take care of their children, to cook for them, to do all these kinds of things. Edward Prescott goes around, he says, you Germans, he says, if you were working a lot more, then you wouldn't have to buy all this stuff at IKEA that you have to put together yourself. You could buy No, I'm serious. This is what he says. This is what he says. He says you can buy stuff that is already put together for you. You know, and you will maximize your economic outcomes in doing so. So, you know, in fact, he's a very smart fellow, and what he says is in the terms that he's thinking is totally correct. But the problem is it doesn't recognize that people, in fact, might want to take care of their own children. They might want to, you know, learn how to cook. They might want to do all kinds of things that they aren't the best at doing because it gives them a more full, a more diverse, a more interesting life. Now, we used to have a term, and I'm being a little harsh here, but I think we used to think of people who thought as narrowly as Edward Prescott, who could be so brilliant in his econometrics and things that he could win a Nobel Prize, but who could put out this kind of stuff saying everybody should just work like mad in their own thing and maximize everything and then hire somebody else to do everything else. That kind of narrow thing, we used to call that an idiot savant. You know, and I think we have to begin to think a little bit that way about, you know, what is the economy for? What is life about? What do we really want to do? And that's the that'll be some of the topics that I'll be you know, I'll be continuing that. But of course there are objections. Yes.
I don't like to defend Prescott. He's not my kind of economist, although, you know, he's neoclassical.
No, but he does say these things.
Part of the problem with Germany and France, we saw last year with the rioting in France, is that France has a terrible problem with structural unemployment.
They do.
And Germany does too. And so one of the problems that Prescott's addressing is you're having trouble getting everybody to work. Okay? And so it's not just that you ought to be working harder because you're all already working ought to work harder. It's how do you address this persistent problem of structural unemployment in Europe, which the United States does not have.
Your point is well taken, and he does say that. But does the United States have any problem of structural unemployment?
Yes.
I might argue that we have a rather serious problem. We have 2.1 million people unemployed in this country who are not counted in anybody's unemployed rolls. They exist in places we call prisons. And if we compare what has happened in the United States, and this is another graph that I could show you from 1970 to 2000, you know that France has fewer prisoners today than they did in 1970, 1980, fewer. Finland has much fewer. Germany has a little bit more. The United States has twice as many. We now have 2.1 million. We incarcerate people. In Europe, these people would be unemployed. They would be structurally unemployed in many cases.
Pardon? You can't say that they'd all be unemployed because they're...
No, I don't mean they'd all be unemployed, but what I'm saying is many of these folks would have trouble making it economically. And in this country might turn to activity we consider criminal in order to make it. And then our solution to them would be to put them away. The solution in Europe often would be to put them on some kind of dole, you know. It's a different choice. But I think it's not fair. I think it's fair to say that there are problems in France and Germany with structural unemployment that need work. There are also European countries that have these models have pretty low unemployment. But I think it's true what you say about France and Germany. But it's not true to act like we don't have some of these problems, and I think a lot of people don't consider the prisoners or, you know, major other things in our unemployment rolls. I mean, is that wrong?
Our open borders, is that?
Well, we do have pretty open borders. They now have pretty open borders as well. Immigration in Europe.
Not as open as ours.
No, it's about two-thirds. The rate of immigration is about two-thirds in Western Europe today as what it is here in the U.S.
But that statistic isn't even known here because they're illegal. They're not registered. Over there, they are registered.
Well, that's true. Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm sure they have illegals too. I would
illegals as well.
I would doubt that you know we would have the only illegals. Mm-hmm. But yes.
The whole issue around employment, it intersects with education. And, you know, I think in our society we've not found, with the way our educational system's set up, is a way of tracking high school dropouts or or when they leave our educational system? What is the data between the European system and that, and the structure and employment in that young population compared to ours? Because, you know, I think there's a huge demographic we are not accounting for or addressing, and maybe that's another statistic that how you do that.
We do way better. We have a much higher percentage of the population that graduates from high school. The Europeans are finally starting to catch up to us.
But can we, I don't know if statistically we're really tracking that.
Yeah, no, they do.
I don't know.
Well, we do, but I wouldn't say we have a much higher percentage. We
used to have a much higher percentage. I mean,
yeah,
but
it's changing.
It's changing.
And some of the majors, education is a complicated.
Oh yeah, yeah. I agree.
Absolutely.
But in terms of high school graduates, that's really counted very well.
I'm saying we
it's counted very well.
Yeah. Well, in Europe, did they not have a place where if the students didn't pass certain tests at a certain level, they were shuffled off into basically trade schools.
They would do.
So they did not graduate from school, but they were taught something. And of course, you know, in American schools, we don't have shop classes anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, and the education thing is quite complicated. I would absolutely agree. Functional illiteracy is a little higher here, and all the stats show that people coming out of high school here are not as literate as the equivalent in Europe in the testing. But I want to make one point, which is often it's said that you can't compete and do things the way they're doing. That globalization makes it such that we have to eliminate all these kind of safety nets and various kinds of things that are done in these countries, and I'll talk more about some of the safety nets tomorrow, particularly as they affect families and working families. But it's said that you can't do this. And to be very simplistic about it, most of these economies are already considerably more globalized than the U.S. In most cases, at least 30%, you know, for instance, of their market comes from somewhere else and goes out to somewhere else. In a country like the Netherlands, almost 60% of the economy is globalized. In the United States, that figure is much smaller. But when we see how do countries do in terms of global economic competition, we have the World Economic Forum, which is Bill Gates and company and corporate leaders who meet in this Swiss resort each year called Davos, and they label countries about how economically competitive they are. And you know what? The U.S. does wonderfully. We're way up there. We're number two by the latest measure. We are a very, very competitive economy. There's no question about it, and I don't want to argue it. You can do it our way and be competitive, and we do a good job of doing that. But you don't have to do it our way, and that's the important thing. When you look at the other top four countries in the top five, according to the World Economic Forum, what are those countries? Any guess?
Ireland.
Pardon?
Ireland.
No.
Norway
is one. They all, by the way, are Lutheran countries.
Yeah.
Norway,
Germany.
Sweden,
Germany.
Not Germany, no.
Denmark.
Finland, somebody said Finland, number one. According to the World Economic Forum, the most competitive economy in the world is Finland. Number two is the United States, then it's Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. I mean, that's how, and then other Western European countries down the list. Yes? So, Finland is a very interesting thing, because you say, what do we know about Finland?
Well, technology.
Yeah, technology is a big thing, Nokia and all those kind of things. But one thing we know about Finland is that Finland is either number one or number two, depending on whose studies you look at, as being the most egalitarian country in the world. Finland has the smallest gap between rich and poor of any country. So you don't necessarily have to have this wide, wide gap in order to be competitive. Finland also has people get 30 days of vacation. It's one of only two countries in the world where you can't even make someone work overtime without their agreeing to it, volunteering to do it. Portugal is the other country. In Finland, if they want you, you have to agree to work overtime. People do it, and they often people want to make the money, but you have to agree to do that. Finland is also the country the UN says has the most chance of being environmentally sustainable 100 years from now. It has the least corruption, according to studies of corruption in government, and it is true what John says, that there's a huge connection between wealthy countries. It's not a perfect connection, the wealthiest, et cetera, but there's a huge connection between things like corruption, participation in government, all those things. And the other thing is that Finnish students do the best on standardized tests of any youth in the world. They score, they're number one. Funny thing about that is that Finnish students also spend more of their time on what subjects than the students in any other country in the world. Anyone run a guess? Pardon? Art is one. What's the other one?
Music.
Yeah, art and music. So again, you can get people doing all spending all their time studying for tests, but here the kids who do the best in the tests aren't being taught like that at all. Yes, they do get quite a lot of math and science, they do, but they also get art and music, and they're not just trained that it's about passing tests. So the final comment that I would make is then people will say, well, look at Finland, 5 million people, homogeneous society. True. There are advantages to that, no question about it, for Finland. But Finland also faces some rather serious disadvantages as an economy. What might be some of the disadvantages Finland would face?
Snow.
Well, yeah, two-thirds of the country is above the Arctic Circle, I think, for one thing. So there's long winters and things. That's a part of it. Not, pardon?
Oh, they were just saying winter, but I said that's the wrong way, because the more north you are, the richer you are. There's a real strong correlation.
Well, that
distance from the equator and wealth.
That's true, but that has, I think, more to do with some of the...
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
But there's no simple... Winter doesn't have a simple...
Yes. Okay, and...
Location?
It's a problem. I mean, with 5 minutes... How many people in the world speak Finnish? No, we have one. A little over 5 million. So the Finns have to, and the Finns' economy is tremendously globalized because they have a very small domestic market to sell to. So they have got to be able to compete and sell to these other kinds of markets. They have to train people to speak other languages in order to be able to do that. They don't have phenomenal resources. They have a lot of timber, pretty good in that regard, but not so great in many other areas. So yes, it's true that the Finns have advantages of homogeneity and a kind of a small collective society, but they also have disadvantages, and those things are often never pointed out when people often say, oh, well, it's just because that's a little country. I would argue that that's not the case. People will also say, well, we in the U.S. are about small business, you know, and you can't do these social safety things with small business. It's too hard for small business. But you know that, what percentage of U.S. businesses are small businesses? It's about half. But in the EU, it's about 67%. More small businesses in the European countries. They haven't been taken over as much by some of the other things. So this is these are some of the points that I want to make, and I'm going way too far now. But I hope that this gets in. I think John and I will have a lot of fun because we agree on some things very much, and we obviously disagree on some things, and that's what Holden should be about is conversation about honest disagreement and seeing each other's point of view and so forth. So I welcome this opportunity to spend time with you. Tomorrow we'll be talking about family policy in the U.S., and I'll be showing a film called Another Hood Manifesto tomorrow night, which is a film version of a book by the founder of MoveOn.org, a film that I just finished making a month ago. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about conscious consuming. You want to buy stuff? Can you buy stuff that also helps folks strictly through the market, using the market on a voluntary basis? What can we do through things like fair trade, forest stewardship councils, certification, and so forth, and we'll show a film in the evening about that. And then on Thursday, we'll be talking about the world, some of the global issues that John's talking about, particularly the issue of hunger, and if there are things that we can do about that, and Friday be something of a wrap up. But thank you all. always wonderful to be at Holden, and you can all be proud of what the Lutherans have done.